Matthew Good, and much, much more. Plus, 40 films and 4 huge free public concerts downtown. Get it all for just $50 with a North by Northeast wristband. Buy online and get full festival details at www.nxne.com. North by Northeast, celebrating 18 years of great music. Working for
Get ready for Volume 4 of Next Music from Tokyo. A mayhem of indie Japanese music will descend on Vancouver Wednesday, May 23rd at the Waldorf Hotel, featuring Japan's best and brightest rock legends. The Zazen Boys, Group Inu, Charan Porantan, and Praha Depart. Next Music from Tokyo is a non-profit cross-Canada tour showcasing the best independent and underground music from Japan. Volume 4 of Next Music from Tokyo, Wednesday, May 23rd at the Waldorf Hotel.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, May 18th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us on News 101. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:07 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
Right now, we will go straight to Democracy Now! For your international headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Florida prosecutors have released a trove of documents revealing new details about the night George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. The evidence indicates a fight occurred between the two, but police determined the deadly encounter was, quote, ultimately avoidable if Zimmerman had remained in his vehicle and awaited the arrival of law enforcement. The police also concluded, quote, there is no indication Trayvon Martin was involved in any criminal activity at the time of the encounter. Autopsy results show Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest with a bullet going through his heart. The new documents also show Sanford police received an anonymous tip less than 2 full days after the shooting, before it became widely known to the public. The caller refused to identify herself but said Zimmerman, quote, has racist ideologies and is fully capable of instigating a confrontation that could have escalated to the point of him having used deadly force. The caller was never tracked down. We'll have more on the Trayvon Martin case later in the broadcast. We'll speak with the president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, in Florida. Hundreds of people rallied in Houston Thursday to protest the acquittal of a former police officer and the videotape beating of an African-American teenager. On Wednesday, the officer, Andrew Bloomberg, was found not guilty by an all-white jury in the beating and stomping of 15-year-old burglary suspect Chad Holly. Video taken of the March 2010 incident shows Holly being stopped by a police vehicle. After Holly falls to the ground, he's clearly seen surrendering and putting his hands behind his head. But instead of placing him in handcuffs, Bloomberg and six fellow officers proceed to attack Holly with stomps and kicks. Bloomberg and the other officers lost their jobs after the video emerged. Three of the officers will learn of their trial dates next week. The U.S. has issued what could be its most forceful threat to date of a potential attack on Iran. Speaking at a public event in Jerusalem, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, said the Obama administration's made preparations for military action. Shapiro said the U.S. would prefer a peaceful resolution to the standoff over Iran's nuclear activities, but he added, quote, that doesn't mean that the military option is not fully available, and not just available, but it's ready. The necessary planning's been done to ensure that it's ready, unquote. The Obama administration, meanwhile, granted an Israeli request for an additional $70 million to fund a so-called missile defense program known as Iron Dome. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said the Pentagon will request the funding over the next 3 years. The money would come on top of more than $200 million already allocated for the system and the additional $3 billion in annual U.S. military aid. Republicans say the U.S. funding for Iron Dome doesn't go far enough and are advancing a measure that would give Israel an additional $680 million. Speaking at a meeting with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak thanked the White House for its support.
I'm delighted to be here once again and to have an opportunity to discuss Middle Eastern issues with the Secretary. We are here, I was in the Pentagon, and we are highly appreciative of the approach of this administration, of the Secretary of Defense, and of course of the President in regard to the security of Israel, making sure that in our tough neighborhood, Israel will be strong and secure.
Israel, meanwhile, has launched new attacks on the occupied Gaza Strip. On Thursday, seven Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces opened fire near the Israel-Gaza border. At least three of the victims were said to be farmers. Another Palestinian farmer said he fled the shooting.
And we left our tools behind us. We also left our donkeys and cars to the east from here. Suddenly, the Israelis started to shoot on us, so we ran away.
An Egyptian court has acquitted 14 police officers charged with killing protesters during the uprising against the regime of Hosni Mubarak last year. The officers were accused of firing on demonstrators outside of police stations in the early stages of the protests. So far, 9 out of 10 cases where Egyptian officers have been tried for killing protesters have ended in acquittals. The 10th case ended in a suspended sentence. The Obama administration continues to ease restrictions on Burma in the aftermath of parliamentary elections and the release of political prisoners. On Thursday, the U.S. said it'll name its first ambassador to Burma in 20 years. Speaking in Washington, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also announced the U.S. will ease the ban on trading and other investments in Burma.
I am also announcing new steps to permit American investment in the country and export of U.S. financial services. These are the most significant adjustments to our previous policy that have been taken to date. The United States will issue a general license that will enable American businesses to invest across the economy, allow citizens access to international credit markets and dollar-based transactions. So today, we say to American business, invest in Burma and do it responsibly. Be an agent of positive change.
Events and marches were held across the globe Thursday to mark the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. Countries to take part in included Cuba, which has recently taken steps to account for the persecution of LGBTQ people in the 60s and 70s. U.S. activist Anna Dorman was in Cuba to take part.
We're very happy and excited to be here. We're very impressed with how open the community is to both us and to this talk, to discuss this theme, which we think is very important. We're here in solidarity with the people of Cienfuegos and the people of Cuba to really promote education and awareness and consciousness raising so that we reduce homophobia and increase openness to diversity.
The House has passed a Republican-backed version of a bill reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, a sweeping law that aids victims of domestic violence. But critics say the House version excludes protections for Native American and LGBT victims passed by the Senate and rolls back existing protections for immigrant women. The White House has threatened to veto the House version, saying it undermines the core purpose of the law. And the New York Times has revealed a Republican super PAC is planning an ad campaign that would revive the effort to link President Obama to his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Sound bites of Wright's sermons became a dominant staple of the 2008 campaign when Republicans tried to associate Obama with Wright's denunciations of U.S. foreign policy and its record on civil rights. A newly disclosed plan shows strategists with the Ending Spending Action Fund writing, quote, "The world is about to see Jeremiah Wright and understand his influence on Barack Obama for the first time in a big, attention-arresting way," unquote. The $10 million plan was commissioned and funded by the billionaire Joe Ricketts, the founder of the brokerage firm TD Ameritrade. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world. World leaders are...
Enough.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. German police detained 400 anti-austerity protesters in Frankfurt today as thousands took to the streets. The demonstrators are taking part in a four-day Blockupy protest organized by about 40 different organizations. The protests in Germany's financial capital are due to run through Saturday. FSRN's Cinnamon Nepard has more.
Demonstrators defied German authorities who banned the protests yesterday and today. German police have locked down the city's financial district, blocking streets around the European Central Bank and minimizing traffic outside the Deutsche Bank headquarters. Protesters are criticizing the way that governments are responding to the financial crisis, saying that austerity measures are punishing ordinary people for the actions of banks and investors. The European Central Bank has come under fire but has defended its position on austerity, saying the measures have already prevented a major credit crunch. Around 30,000 protesters are expected over the weekend. Cinnamon Nipad, FSRN, Germany.
In India, the controversy continues over how to dispose of toxic waste left at a U.S. company's industrial site after the 1984 Bhopal gas disaster. Local communities have balked at proposals to incinerate the waste nearby, and now an international option is emerging. FSRN's Shreya Niazi reports from Bhopal.
The Madhya Pradesh government and German company GIZ held talks this week about the waste remaining at the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. GIZ had recently offered to incinerate 350 metric tons of toxic waste at a facility in Hamburg, Germany. A team from the company visited the Carbide plant and met with state government officials. Local media report GIZ is likely to charge $2.6 million US for airlifting and disposing of the waste. National officials had recommended that the waste be incinerated at a plant in Prithampura in Madhya Pradesh. But the state government and NGOs have opposed that plan, arguing that the local facility is not capable of handling the toxic waste. The Indian Supreme Court halted the Prithampura disposal plan late last week. Shura Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Documents released this week by the Florida State Attorney's Office reveal several new pieces of information about the Trayvon Martin shooting incident. Among them was a police report that found George Zimmerman could have avoided a confrontation with the African-American teen if he had stayed in his car and waited 6 minutes for the authorities to arrive. The police report called the incident ultimately avoidable. The report also said there was no indication that Martin was involved in any criminal activity. Police photos and a medical report leaked to media yesterday did indicate Zimmerman had been injured in a scuffle, and other documents reveal it had been Zimmerman calling for help during a confrontation with Martin. In another interview released, Martin's girlfriend, who was on the phone with the teen right before he was shot, said Trayvon was out of breath after running away from someone. The unnamed girl also said she had heard Martin asking why the person was following him and then yelling, "Get off." A toxicology report did show Martin's blood had trace amounts of THC, the chemical in marijuana, but CNN reports that the levels would not even have been enough to get someone arrested for DUI in some states. The new political party, Americans Elect, is shutting down its primary process, saying no candidate gained enough national support to qualify for the group's online convention planned for June. There had been speculation that the political group would put forth a candidate anyway, since it had gained ballot access in a majority of U.S. states. But in a statement posted Thursday, party leadership said that Americans Elect had from the outset been a rules-based process, and that the rules governing convention qualification would stand. The group also said it intends to continue its mission of, quote, creating more choice in our political system. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. For more daily headlines and their full newscast, you can go to Free Speech Radio News at FSRN.org. And now we're going to take a quick PSA, but do stay with us for your local, provincial, and national headlines.
Menzo Nagano was the first Japanese citizen to officially immigrate to Canada. He arrived in New Westminster in 1877 as a stowaway aboard a British ship. He later relocated to Victoria, and for 35 years he worked jobs loading timber and fishing for salmon until he returned to Japan in 1922.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Asian Heritage Month by CITR 101.9.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold. But the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot in saloon?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building here at the University of British Columbia. I'm Claire Eagle. I'm joined by CJ, and it's now time for our local weather forecast by the UBC Storm Club with our own Phil Chang.
Thank you, Claire, and good evening, listeners. If I had to describe the next 3 days in one word, I think I would choose the word mixed. A warm front followed immediately by a cold front speedily passing through our area, all within 72 hours.
Oh, no.
It's a mumble jumble. It's very difficult to predict the effect of either system on our local weather, but overall, we can confidently anticipate cloud cover and perhaps some rain when the cold front takes full effect Sunday evening. But apart from that, wow, mixed wind directions, mixed warming and cooling spikes, and mixed pressure trends, mixed everything. Tonight, all right, now for your weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, we have partly cloudy, low of 12. Saturday, mostly cloudy, and high of 14, low of 12. Sunday, we predict overcast with a 50% chance of some light rain, high of 13, low of 11. So that's your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. It is currently 14 degrees on UBC campus. At home, reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Phil. It's too bad that we're going to have a bit of a mumbo-jumbo weather there. It'd be nice to have some perfect weather for the weekend, but I guess that's can't have everything. So thank you again for the weather report.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So once again, that was Phil Chang with the weather. We now go to our local headlines.
UBC has announced that it won't be returning to Access Copyright. UBC is a member of the Association of Canadian Colleges and Universities, or ACCU, which recently agreed to draft a deal with Access Copyright, a publishing organization that centrally controls rights for academic materials such as course packs. Access Copyright had been performing that role for UBC until 2011, after reviewing the ACCU deal, UBC has decided they're not going to sign up. The decision ends just under 2 years of uncertainty on the issue. Access Copyright first proposed a $45 per student flat rate in 2010. Later, they agreed to a deal with the ACCU that laid out a $26 per student as a model rate for individual schools to approve. The deal, in effect, prior to 2010, charged $3.38 per student and 10 cents per printed page. But in response to the $45 per student proposal, UBC decided to leave the service in 2011. Alan Bell, UBC Director for Library Digital Initiatives, said that UBC already pays over $10 million for electronic licenses, which is a cost over and above the amount charged by Access Copyright. In a broadcast email sent out May 15th, which was the deadline for deciding whether or not to sign on to the deal, UBC criticized Access Copyright for charging too much, as well as providing only a limited repertoire of material. In response, Bell said the university will be opening a physical copyright office and will continue to operate under the Copyright Advisory Group.
Daniel Werb, Senior Research Assistant at the Addiction and Urban Health Research Initiative at the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, has been awarded the 2012 Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation Doctoral Scholarship for his PhD research project investigating initiation and cessation of injection drug use among street youth in Vancouver. Verb's thesis focuses on mapping out the full cycle of injection drug use, from the circumstances under which individuals begin to inject drugs to determining what may make them more likely to cease their use. The Trudeau Foundation scholarship is worth up to $180,000 in funding over 3 years. In addition to the financial assistance, the Trudeau scholarship offers recipients the opportunity to interact with a community of scholars, leaders, and policymakers in every field of the social sciences and humanities. Pierre Joliet-Forest, president of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, said that, quote, Mr. Verb is doing important research that will help inform effective, evidence-based drug policy reform to improve the health and safety of people who use drugs and the communities in which they live, end quote.
UBC's Graduate Student Society, or GSS, has reached an agreement with CUPE 116, the union that represented the former workers at Kerner's Pub, and it is possible that the pub could reopen as early as this September. A group of GSS executives and a bargaining unit from pub staff union CUPE 116 finished off a year of negotiations last week with a new agreement. The GSS is now looking to a third-party operator to run the pub's day-to-day operations, and they hope to have the place up and running before the start of the fall term. The new agreement needs to be ratified by GSS Council as well as CUPE executives, but both parties say they are extremely confident the agreement will be approved. According to Lance, the new agreement fulfills the union's original request for regular wage increases. New workers will be hired at wages, quote, in and around $12 an hour. That is according to David Lance, bargaining representative from CUPE 116, which GSS President Connie Lynn said fulfills the union's hope for a consumer price index-based increase. the Graduate Student Society decided to close the pub last year because it was losing money, but President Lin says that overstaffing was the main reason for the shortfall. The pub, Gunners Pub, lost nearly $200,000 from the beginning of 2010 until its closure in 2011. But some of the losses may have also been due to a liquor license suspension in 2010.
The charity behind Vancouver's supervised injection site has applied for a city permit to run its mobile needle exchange in Abbotsford. The PHS Community Services Society has been driving a van full of clean medical supplies to the city for 4 hours a week for the last 8 months. Since then, advocates have been trying to have an unenforced 2005 city bylaw banning harm reduction measures such as needle exchanges and supervised injection sites overturned. The Society's Executive Director Mark Townsend said on Friday that, quote, no local residents have complained at all, and that, quote, the police parked behind the van, but they've done nothing, end quote. UBC medical anthropologist Dr. Dan Small sent a letter to Abbotsford Mayor Bruce Banman and all the city councillors Wednesday on behalf of the PHS Community Services Society, urging them to consider the peer-reviewed evidence that needle exchanges save lives and millions in healthcare costs. Townsend said he is very optimistic that City Council will take the necessary steps to remove the legal ambiguity around the needle exchange. He thinks that would put pressure on the Fraser Health Authority to fund the initiative, the way Vancouver Coastal Health funds InSight, Vancouver's injection site. City Council is scheduled to review the business license application on May 28th. And a fish farm off Vancouver Island's west coast says it plans to cull Atlantic salmon after federal officials quarantined a facility over fears of a virus. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency said it's investigating a suspected finding of an infectious virus, hematopoietic necrosis. My apologies to anyone who knows viruses, because that was probably wrong, in a BC aquaculture facility. The agency says the virus poses risks to aquatic animal health, but does not affect human health or food safety, and the facility is under quarantine. Mainstream Canada says it has begun to depopulate an Atlantic salmon farm near Tofino, BC. The Norwegian-owned company says the fish will be removed, euthanized, and transported to a composting facility. Tofino's Friends of Clayocoat Sound says while the virus is endemic to wild Pacific fish, farms tend to amplify diseases much like crowded hospitals. And those were your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your provincial and national headlines.
Cool. Yeah. You've been troubled, you've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no money. The one you love has deserted you. That makes you blue.
Got the blues? Just want to hear some blues? Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 5 for Code Blue. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, www.citr.ca. Code Blue.
Here's how he feels, but blues ain't nothing but a man. Good man feeling bad, no how. That's all that is.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to us on CITR or online at citr.ca, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us, and it's now time for your provincial and national headlines.
BC mayors say they want a new partnership with the federal and provincial governments to deal with spending on local issues from roads to social services. That call was made this Friday at the end of the inaugural meeting of the BC Mayors Caucus, which drew 86 mayors from across BC to Penticton. The mayors say the current ad hoc process for granting funds to municipalities should be replaced by a system that will give cities and towns some certainty about what money they will get in order to allow for long-term planning. The mayors want a coordinated approach to how social services are delivered, sustainable funding if those services are downloaded from the federal or provincial governments, a new cost-sharing formula for major public works projects, and more flexibility in using the federal gas tax. The mayors also want to create two discussion forums, one with the premier to discuss public policy changes that affect local governments, and one with the federal and provincial governments to talk about aging infrastructure. Kamloops Mayor Peter Milobar says it's time for a change in how governments interact, saying municipalities must be partners with senior governments in finding more efficient ways to deliver services.
An environmental group says an 800-year-old red cedar tree has been illegally chopped down in a provincial park on southern Vancouver Island. Torrance Coste of the Wilderness Committee says the poachers apparently began hacking away at the tree about a year ago, and photos show they continued their work up until about 2 weeks ago. Coste says poachers cut through 4/5 of the tree a year ago and left it to stand. Park staff later had the damaged tree cut down before it could become a hazard. It was supposed to lay on the ground and rot, returning its nutrients to the soil, but poachers made off with the rest of the wood over the course of a few months, he said. Coste says a stump measuring about 3 meters across is all that remains of the tree. He says that no one saw the tree being chopped down or dragged across a parking area where steel cables were left lying around. The Wilderness Committee points out that funding cuts have left only 10 full-time park rangers to monitor about 1,000 parks and protected areas across BC. Tree poaching from provincial parks happens annually, but the impact is low, said Environment Minister Terry Lake at a press scrum before the legislature on the 17th.
The first ever quality of life comparison of provinces and territories to other countries suggests that while most Canadians live as well as anyone in the world, others are well down the list. The Centre for the Study of Living Standards took the Human Development Index and applied it to provinces and territories. The index is a statistical tool in wide use around the world, combining factors such as health, education, and income to compare how well people in various countries live. The researchers found that British Columbia, Alberta, Ontario, and the Northwest Territories, jurisdictions home to the majority of Canadians, would be in a five-way tie for third spot overall, with the Netherlands if considered alone as countries. This puts them just below Norway and Australia in first and second place. Of the three, Alberta ranked marginally higher than BC, Ontario, and the Northwest Territories. Alberta's education scores stand out because the province has high rates of educational attainment, but relatively low school enrollment rates. Researchers attributed the anomaly to the booming oil business, which allows many young people to get high-paying jobs with only a high school education. Other provinces and territories aren't far behind. Quebec, at 11, is next on the list, while Prince Edward Island, the second last jurisdiction, comes in at 24th. Nunavut, however, is ranked 38, just above Hungary and Poland. The gap between Nunavut and Prince Edward Island is greater than the gap between all other Canadian jurisdictions. Overall, Canada ranks 6th in the world in the index, behind Norway, Australia, the Netherlands, the United States, and New Zealand.
Retired politician and social worker Dave Barrett was named the Order of BC yesterday, along with Kim Campbell and 12 others. While Premier Barrett's government substantially reformed the welfare system, initiated a number of reforms such as establishing the province's Labor Relations Board, and expanded the public sector. Kim Campbell is a Canadian politician, lawyer, professor, diplomat, and writer. She's Canada's first female Minister of Justice and eventually succeeded Brian Mulroney to become Canada's first and only female Prime Minister and the first and only Prime Minister born in British Columbia.
The Canadian Taxpayers Federation says gasoline taxes will suck $1 billion out of the wallets of drivers in Metro Vancouver this year. The Federation's BC director, Jason Bateman, says drivers elsewhere in the province will pay a further $800 million in taxes to various levels of government and transit authorities. He says in the Metro Vancouver region, the increases in the carbon tax and the gas tax that goes to TransLink will result in drivers paying nearly 50 cents a litre in gas taxes, which he says is the highest on the continent. The tax that goes to TransLink rose 2 cents a litre in April, while the carbon tax rises 1.1% on July 1st. Bateman says people living in the Victoria area will pay $133 million in gas tax this year, while drivers outside the Lower Mainland and Victoria regions will hand over another $687 million a year.
And those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We now
go to an excellent interview by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now!, where they interview Raymond Offenheiser, the president of the International Relief and Development Organization, Oxfam America. They also talk to Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is co-director of itsoureconomy.us and organizer of Occupy Washington, D.C., and she's recently helped organize the Occupy G8 People's Summit outside of Camp David.
Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world. World leaders are convening at the heavily guarded Camp David in Maryland today for the G8 Summit. The G8 comprises eight world leaders who meet face-to-face annually at a summit that has become a focus of media attention and protest action. The focus of this year's summit will be the European economic crisis, but other topics on the agenda include the conflict in Syria, nuclear nonproliferation, and global food security. President Obama will kick off the weekend with a speech in Washington outlining his plans for helping developing countries. He's expected to promote private sector investments rather than public sector solutions. The G8's new food security initiative is facing some criticism because it includes no financial pledges. Leading nonprofits such as Save the Children and Oxfam are urging G8 leaders to live up to their promise of 3 years ago to donate $22 billion toward food security in developing nations. By the G8's own accounting, it has only delivered a quarter of that amount. This year, activists are calling on the leaders of the eight richest countries to build on their previous commitments and partner with developing countries to urgently tackle hunger.
For more, we're joined by two guests. From Baltimore, Maryland, Dr. Margaret Flowers is with us. She helped organize the Occupy G8 People's Summit. She's a pediatrician, single-payer advocate, co-director of itsoureconomy.us, and organizer of Occupy Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Raymond Offenheiser. He is president of Oxfam America. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Raymond Offenheiser, let's begin with you. First of all, I bet most people in this country don't even know what the G8 countries are. And then we'll talk about the significance of this meeting that was, in a surprise to many, moved from Chicago, where it was to precede the NATO summit this weekend, to the isolated Camp David.
Well, the G8 countries are the most industrialized or wealthiest countries in the world and comprised mostly of Europe, United States, Canada, Australia, and a number of major European economies. And they have been convening for a number of years around a variety of strategic issues of the sort that you just mentioned. And as you indicated, for organizations like Save the Children and Oxfam, top of mind is the global food crisis, which started in 2009. And which is the centerpiece of the events this morning. The president will be making a major speech to launch the summit this morning at 10 o'clock.
And Raymond Offenheiser, what about this pledge that was made back in 2009 of $22 billion to address food security? How much of it has actually been delivered, and what are you calling for?
Well, the countries, President Obama in Italy, in the L'Aquila summit of 2009, exercised bold leadership in calling upon the G8 at that particular time to actually confront the major challenge of the global food crisis. And I think it's important for your listeners and viewers to remember that at that particular time, food prices had spiked some 300% in various countries around the world. There were riots in 38 countries. There was real questions about whether certain governments were going to survive that political instability. There was a recognition that food stocks were exhausted, and there was a real need to invest in agriculture. And the president stepped forward and really said, we need a bold commitment from the G8 to really move an agenda forward. He put money on the table. Others committed up to $22 billion with the idea there would be $7 billion spent over the next 3 years. I think the question now, really, for this summit is, will that commitment at those levels of funding continue for the next 3 years to 2015, or will there be, in the face of all the fiscal crisis around the world, will the ambition be lower than that? And I guess our concern is really, will the ambition going into this summit be commensurate with the scale of the problem, which hasn't gone away? And in some ways, you could say, is worsening with the emergence of a major food crisis in West Africa and the Sahelian region.
Juan and I were talking before the show about just who these G8 countries are. Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, the United States, and Britain. Dr. Margaret Flowers, why have you organized this Occupy G8 People Summit outside?
Well, we feel it's important to educate people about the role that the G8 plays. They actually formed in 1975 as the G6, following a 1974 United Nations declaration calling for a new international economic path that created avenues for countries to regulate multinational corporations within their borders, allowed them to determine their economic situation without undue influence, military influence, or other pressure on them from outside countries. And in response to that, these wealthy nations wanted to circumvent these calls for a more inclusive and democratic economic process and have really dominated the economic policies of the world. We want people to know that there are other solutions that are actual true solutions to the crises that we are facing, but those solutions are not being talked about by the G8 leaders.
And Dr. Flowers, you're a pediatrician. You've been a guest on Democracy Now! Many times in the past, talking about advocating for single-payer health insurance. But now you have broadened out considerably in terms of the issue of the G8 summit. Why is that?
Well, to be honest, if we want to create a healthy population in our country and around the world, we have to address the underlying issue of wealth inequality. That's driving so many of our health issues. When people don't have a job with a living wage, when they aren't treated with respect in their jobs, when they don't have education, a home to live in, access to healthy food and clean water, all of these things are connected. And all of us who advocate on these different issues of single issue advocacy are not able to confront the concentrated wealth that controls our political process and that corporate media message. And so if we want to create a healthy population, we have to address all these issues. And if we want to be able to address any of them, we need to work together effectively to create a mass movement that calls for real change and put forth real solutions to the problems that we're facing.
Raymond Offenheiser, I know you're about to head off to President Obama's address. But I was wondering if you can link what's happening in Europe, the economic crises, the austerity measures that are being imposed on a number of countries, and what's happening here in this country with the issue of hunger and poverty around the world.
Well, I think the most direct implication for the developing countries is are the members of the G8. Do they see investment in foreign aid to address some of these major crises happening in Africa, Asia, and Latin America around the food issue and so forth? Do they have the money now, or do they have the political will to provide the money to meet the commitments that they have? As we can see, going into the summit, the events in Greece, I think, have heightened concerns about the stability of the European economy. And I think in some ways that becomes more of a centerpiece of what people want to talk about. But they tend to forget the fact that the larger conversation at the last summit the summit in L'Aquila, Italy was, we've got to deal with this food crisis. It's an issue that is of worldwide importance. We have a broken global food system, and the security of entire nations depend on this. So I think the real issue here is there going to be the political will to bring the resources and fulfill the promises of L'Aquila in 2009, continue that for a 10-year period so we can address the major structural issues that were discovered in 2009 with adequate resources, political will, and appropriate policy responses. And I think to the point that Dr. Flowers was making, this is all a part of a package of an economic model that is, I think, privileging growth, which is important, and the generation of jobs, and the importance of a private sector role. But at the same time, it needs to be inclusive growth that reaches out to small farmers, women, and prioritizes issues of health, food security, and environment.
But Raymond Offenheiser, even with the existing U.S. aid, I think the food aid of the United States represents about half of all the food aid in the world. But there are all of these strings attached that actually raise the cost of this aid. For instance, all U.S. aid must be purchased from the United States. And also it must be carried on U.S. ships, which obviously raises the overall cost of that aid. Are you advocating any kind of efficiencies to reduce these overhead costs that actually assure that much of the aid doesn't really get to the people in need?
Absolutely. Oxfam has been advocating for probably the last 6 or 7 years for reform of our food aid system. Basically, it's a very inefficient system. It's dominated by an iron triangle of the Farm Bureau, shippers, millers, and not-for-profit organizations that receive monetized food aid through that system. It's been around for quite a number of years, but as you say, a lot of the money, probably some 50% at a minimum, is going to the shippers and to the farmers in the United States. So for the American taxpayer, we're getting a lot less food to the people that need it than we would if we actually bought that food locally. So the reform agenda that Oxfam and others have been pushing really promotes the idea that the U.S. government leadership or the head of USAID be given the flexibility to be buying a lot more of that food locally, spending the taxpayers' dollar more wisely. And one would think in the time of fiscal austerity, this would be something that would be top of mind. But there's a lot of special interests in Washington who want to keep the status quo, sustain this inefficient system, and in effect, not deliver real value for the taxpayer.
And Margaret Flowers, with the G8 summit protests and the move of the summit from Chicago to the isolated and heavily guarded Camp David retreat, how will your protests take effect, and what are you planning during those protests?
Well, there are actually 2 days of protests going on. Today we're going to be focused on our People's Summit, where we do talk about real solutions to the crises that we're facing. Importantly, we'll be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, when you talk about secrecy, this is something that's being negotiated in secret. It's kind of the new code word for free trade, is now these partnerships, and we want fair trade, not free trade. Tomorrow there will be groups, and actually today and tomorrow there will be groups in Camp David in Thurmont, Maryland, where Camp David is, holding signs for visibility. And then tomorrow there'll be an all-day event in Frederick that families are invited to. Again, education about who are the G8, what's going on, what are the policies that they're putting forth, how does that contrast with what we really require? Because as Raymond said, global wealth is increasing, but we're not seeing that distributed to the people around the world or being used to meet our human needs. It's primarily going to the top, and we need to democratize the economy to reduce the wealth inequality globally.
Does Occupy G8 People Summit and the protests organized outside take credit for the move from Chicago to Camp David? I mean, Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Chicago on Monday. We'll be covering the NATO protests all weekend. Chicago is going to be the site of both mass protests until they suddenly pulled the G8 out.
Right, and I'll be in Chicago as well. I'm leaving Saturday afternoon to go there. I think it was some of the pressure of knowing that there were a number of groups coming to Chicago to highlight and expose what the G8 does that caused them to retreat to a more secretive and protected location. We really decided that we would organize something in response to that, that if they were coming to a different location, we needed to continue to have some sort of a response and presence and visibility there.
And finally, Ray Offenheiser, the issue in this country, especially the Republicans, but a number of Democrats as well, saying the answer lies in the private sector. How does that work when it comes to helping people around the world and trying to deal with poverty and hunger?
Well, certainly there's a role for the private sector, and I think maybe one of the important things to understand about one of the major initiatives that will be announced this morning in the president's speech is a new alliance for food security and nutrition that is going to be a centerpiece of the administration's presentation. I think from our point of view, there is a role for the private sector, but private sector is not only large corporations, it's also small enterprises, and you might also say even small women farmers are part of the private sector. One of the concerns I think a lot of civil society actors have from that are here, President Washington, and that we're working with all over the world, is Is the private sector going to be replacing investment in public sector institutions, state institutions, as the centerpiece of this Lockheed initiative going forward? Or will there be an appropriate balance struck between investing in the public sector institutions in these countries that are really reaching small farmers and women that are at the heart of the solution of the global food crisis? Or are we going to shift to a large corporate-based private sector initiative with the idea that that may be the panacea? Our view is, and Oxfam works with private sector firms both here domestically and internationally on a variety of different initiatives. We work with Swiss Re and in Ethiopia on a small farmer insurance program. We work here in the United States with other companies that are trying to actually work with farm worker groups and so forth. So it's not about an either-or proposition. It's a both-and. I guess what we're looking for in the meeting is a strong, continuing commitment to investment in public sector institutions that are whose purpose is actually to reach small farmers and women, with the complement, an appropriate complement and balance with private sector participation broadly defined, with a real focus on pro-poor solutions at the heart of it, ensuring that poor people are going to be included and that we're going to be addressing the needs of the 1 billion in the world who are poorly nourished in the world today. So I think the challenge coming out of the summit, as we see it, is will the president and will the G8 members recommit to the Lockheed principles, replenish the trust fund for food security at the World Bank that was a centerpiece of that initiative, fund the African programs that were requested and delivered by African nations. Only six out of some 38 or 30 were actually funded over the last several years. That's an inadequate number. And will we see an appropriate balance between the public and private sector investments going forward, and not a shift from a public sector investment plan to one that's really dominated by private sector interests?
Raymond Oppenheiser, I want to thank you for being with us, president of Oxfam America, as well as Dr. Margaret Flowers, pediatrician and organizer of the Occupy G8 People's Summit outside of Camp David. The protests will then shift to Chicago, which is much of it beginning to be closed down, central Chicago, as the NATO summit gears up for Sunday and Monday. And Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Chicago on Monday. I hope all will tune in. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to Miami to speak with the head of the NAACP as hundreds of documents and audio recordings have come out in the death of Trayvon Martin.
Thank you to Democracy Now! For that really engaging interview. It'll be interesting to see what happens in Chicago on Monday and see if the G8 really is that spark and does create that spark for the Occupy movement that we kind of been waiting for this spring.
Yeah, well, the G8 summit will be at Camp David.
Mm-hmm. Right, because they moved away. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Adbusters has organized events at Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And as Dr. Margaret Flowers mentioned, there will be a people's summit with people from all different ages and families there. So we will be covering that to see how peaceful it is and the progress on all the issues that have to be covered.
Yeah.
So those are your headlines for today, Friday, May 18th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast, listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan. From the entire news team here at CITR, which is just two of us today, but usually there's a lot more, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM and enjoy your long weekend.